Somebody want to kill our lovely tunes? So nice. All right, we'll start a little Proverbs this morning. 10:26, and then we'll finish up in Samuel. Surprise, surprise. 10:26. Let's read that.
Like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes, so is the lazy one to those who send him.
All right. Like vinegar on your teeth. I don't know if any of you guys have ever put vinegar on your teeth. I certainly have not. Vinegar is nasty. Any idea what it does to your teeth?
It stinks.
It makes it gritty, takes the enamel off. It's not pleasant. So you shouldn't eat vinegar. It's nasty. Okay. And smoke to the eyes. What does smoke do when you get it in your eyes? It's an irritant. It makes your eyes water. That concept is likened to the lazy one to those who send him. So what makes you so mad that you grit your teeth and cry? It's someone who you have entrusted with responsibility, something that you need done, that you've maybe delegated. And what happens? What does this person do? What does it mean that they are lazy?
Put it off to tomorrow?
Or put it off till never. They never get it done. They drop the ball. You guys ever been in a situation like that when you're responsible for something and the end result is outside of your control? And Joe, every week you guys are setting up at Southeast, right? Mobile church. Every church I've been in has been a mobile church. Should we stand and welcome? Slow cut. Whoever's here. Making money. It's good. Goes to the Mike Slade Memorial Slush Fund. Gonna eat me a steak. Where was I? Yes. It's a maddening thing when you have delegated stuff and somebody drops the ball on things. Like if Joe comes to church with his responsibilities and the setup team just decided not to set up that morning, right? And there's no sound or no chairs or no whatever. Like that is a maddening process. You're leaning in to guys and gals that have said, man, I'm gonna do this. You can depend on me. And when they don't get it done, it's maddening. One of our staff members who's been here longer than just about everybody else on staff, Katrina Sherfield. Many of you probably don't know who she is. She works behind the scenes. She's been on staff for 12 years. One of the qualities that she possesses in spades is, I should say, the opposite of this. When you ask Katrina to do something, it is done. It is done well. It is done without asking a second time. And it's done 100 times better than you could have done it. One of the reasons that she has been on the staff for so long and she has the freedom that she does, and Brad says, I will shoot you if you try to hire her, is because of that. She is amazing at just managing tasks, and she is dependable. So when Brad says in his world that is pretty chaotic at his level, Katrina, I need you to handle this, he never thinks twice about it. He never asks her again. He never reminds her to do it. It's done, and it's done with excellence every single time. And as a result of that, she has worked her way up in the organization from a gal that wore like 9 hats at the beginning and did a bunch of stuff, and now she's an executive assistant. And I guarantee you she could go somewhere else tomorrow and work for some CEO and go make a ton more money, I would guess, than she's making here at a church because of that skill set that she possesses. And at the end of the day, it's just simply dependability and responsibility. She is consistent and just faithful in those little things and never drops balls. And if something happens, she's aware of it, she explains it, but she doesn't forget stuff, she doesn't just neglect it, she's not lazy in any way. And as we think through things in, again, this world, the church world and otherwise, to get people elevated and our qualities that you want to exalt in individuals when you see those around you, this is a big one. For those of you guys that maybe struggle with the other side of this, if that's you, let me give you a little bit of advice on things that I see in folks that do this well. People that are, by and large, dependable have a very realistic handle on the amount of stuff happening in their lives. and they are very, very slow on the front side to say yes to anything, right? So they take their time, they process, they consider, they weigh out a responsibility, the length of it, the scope of it, the amount of work that's going to be required, and before they commit to it, they've thought through all that, and they're able to see the beginning, the end from the beginning. And when they commit, they're in. They're all in. But they may take a little bit longer on the front side to weigh that out. You don't see people that are flaky and jump in and say, yeah, and then they get weeks or months or whatever into something and go, oh, gosh, man, I just kind of outpunted my coverage. I can't do this. I can't handle this. We see it every year in residency, right? Hence Shay's speech at the beginning about the guy that starts building a building and realizes, oh, I didn't know that I needed blueprints, or I didn't know how much this would cost, or I didn't consider all the things in, and that's why we start with 20-some-odd in today, in March. We don't have the amount that we started with. It happens every year. So if that is something that you guys tend to, if you tend to struggle with that, consider that, okay, and make sure that you've got a good handle on life. That is a quality that will make those that are around you grit their teeth and cry if you are not dependable, and the opposite is true if you are. You will get exalted in any and every circle that you are in. When you say, it's done, give it to me, I'll handle it, and that box is checked, whoever is your superior in whatever organization you were in, we'll see that as a beautiful quality, and that will get you moved up the ladder quickly. All right? Thoughts on that? Okay. Let's go to 1 Sam, shall we? Okay. Not that I'm like, this isn't a vote, so I mean, we're going to 1 Sam. That's all I got. That's what I got for you today. Let me pray for us. Father, thanks for this morning. Thank you for another morning that we can worship you, that we can open your text, that we can learn from, God, these stories that are 3,000 years old as we watch men and women in whose lives you have impacted and shaped, as we see their struggles, as we see their victories, as we see all of their stories unfold before us, God. Would you give us wisdom and insight to glean nuggets from them, to learn from their successes and their failures? Would you keep us, God, far from errors that would end in destruction for our lives, decisions that we could make that would be detrimental to our futures? And God, help us, Father, just to lean into you. God, as we continue to journey through this process, as we're drinking from a fire hose 5 mornings a week in this program, God, would you help remind us that this is not a head issue as much as it is as a heart issue? And Father, would we be reminded of the fact that we want to love you more as we leave this time, and we don't want knowledge to exalt or puff up or make us haughty in any way. We want to make it want it to make us more humble and more dependent and lean on you, God. So as we look at Saul and Jonathan and David to come, God, would you teach us through these men, these women that we'll see as well through this journey. God, give us insight. We love you. In Christ's name, amen. All right. So last week we saw the beginning of Saul's reign, right? The end of the judges is over. We saw Samuel, kind of the beginning of 1 Samuel and his story. Eli, his two bonehead sons, Hophni and Phinehas, the two up-and-coming priests, and the reason that we get to at the end of Samuel's life, both those two knotheads and then Samuel's two sons, Joel and Abijah, is that right? I think those are their names. They are equally knotheads, and the country basically is saying, man, we don't want your sons to be kings or to be judges. We're done with that, so give us a king like the rest of the other nations. So that was one of the reasons. We're going to see another one of the reasons this morning why the nation was clamoring for a king. And we see Samuel anoint a Benjamite, a guy that was the least and the last in his family, a humble guy with great heritage, great family, get exalted to that position, Saul. He looks the part of a king externally. He starts pretty well. We're going to see his demise here this morning. It doesn't take long for him to kind of hit the downhill spiral, if you will, of his journey. So we finished off in chapter 12 last week, picking up in 13:1. We saw some great initial successes of Saul, his character, a lot of things that we liked in this guy. We saw him rescue, by the way, in chapter 11, the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead on the east side of the Jordan. Nahash, king of the Amorites, you guys remember that guy, was attacking them. They were all on the east side of the Jordan. Remember Nahash's name and remember that town, Jabesh-Gilead. We'll see their stories continue this morning as well as in later on in 1 Samuel. Okay. So we see Saul in Samuel in chapter 12 remind Saul, hey, this can work, man. This wasn't God's best. He didn't want you to be king, but if you'll walk with him and the people will be obedient, man, we can make this thing work, right? So chapter 12 was all about Samuel reminding him and the people, be obedient, walk with God, obey him, and this will work, okay? Chapter 13, we're going to see this all now unravel and go south, okay? So we are fast forwarding. By the way, let me throw this up if I can. Let's see.
Do you just bring a trash can?
Throw this up. Oh, man.
Good one, Julian.
Good. Sorry. No, there's several stories in my head. We had a guy years ago. Do you guys know Scotty Larios? He's a drummer at the Well. He's a drummer. He's at the Well as well. But early on, he was our drummer, one of my main band members, and he got really, really sick one night and was like, there's no alternative. So he had a trash can next to him while he was playing drums. Literally on stage, leading worship, vomiting. Like, bro, you're all kinds of committed. So, wow. So he did it. Brad had a night, he was teaching the same deal, and he had to call. He was throwing up and had to call a doc. Literally handed me his notes 45 minutes before. He's like, dude, you may have to preach this sermon. I'm like, oh, no. Not going to happen. But he got a shot at Doradol right before he went on stage and was able to, like, keep it together for an hour and then crashed. What is the name of this thing that I'm looking for? Sorry, I can't multitask. Is this Tech TV Cart?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Tell us more stories.
Tell us more stories, Uncle Mikey.
Come on, Uncle Mike. Tell us when Shay did that thing that was so embarrassing.
Oh, man. The problem is Shay has so much more on me, and he has pictures of all of it. Why is this not working? It says I'm connected.
Tech support.
Every time. Sorry. It says it's connected. It looks like
it's
connected.
He's got more documented evidence.
He does. He's unbelievable. He's a scrapbooking champion of the world.
Did you guys used to pull pranks on each other?
Yeah. It says we're connected. Jeez, I'm showing you the coolest Excel spreadsheet you've ever seen in your life. I know you guys are so excited. Curse you. Turn it off screensaver.
You can take out the HDMI out of the Apple TV.
If we get there, let's see if that works better.
Right. Well, cool.
One more time.
Fantastic Beast.
Pardon?
Did you see Lori?
Friday night, yeah, I'll be there.
Do you have an HDMI cable?
Yeah.
Texas barbecue.
Other one, yeah.
I would say just see how the HDMI is packed to me. And it says,
he's going to show up.
It says, Professor X and Logan dies at the end of the movie.
Freaking Aaron?
Oh, it was the meme that everybody was posting to ruin the movie for you.
And I read that doesn't mean we want the movie.
And I was like, are you kidding me? It's like,
you're such an idiot.
Crap!
He's getting better.
I don't even want to watch the movie anymore.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
We don't know if it's true, though. We don't know.
Read one. Oh,
you were.
No, I'm in one.
I thought you guys wanted to hear an awesome
story.
Yeah. No. Red's ruining a movie.
Look at that.
I want to hear an awesome story, but I don't want to hear that story.
Yeah, no condemnation.
I learned this thing for now. At least watch it.
Okay.
I know it. P.O.P. Hold it down.
Front row.
Dude, it's every year we break up.
You guys need a new iPhone 10.
Yeah, you need to not ruin movies.
Get a Google Pixel.
Okay. Don't breathe, Sean. Don't breathe. All right.
Stop it.
All right. I know you're so excited about Excel spreadsheets. What I want to show you guys is just a kind of a timeline of a couple things to be aware of. So, as we look at Saul's reign, okay, on the left-hand side over here, under year, you've got the year that Saul takes the throne. Across the top, you've got different dudes that are going to come in our story. So, obviously, Samuel, we've seen him, Saul, in his rule where he is at, or Samuel's rule, rather. Our boy Saul is over here. Okay, so this is his column. How old he is. When he started reigning and how many years into that reign he is, David, And the reason I did this for you guys primarily was Jonathan. We're going to see an interesting relationship develop between David and Saul's son, Jonathan. And it's often miss... More better-er?
One more?
Bow better.
Hey, there we go. I was like, I don't know what you're saying.
I know what happens after
that. Yeah, that is a little smaller on my screen, huh?
This guy named Jesus?
What? All right, anyway, so we'll work through this here in a second. But again, just to be aware, so Saul takes the throne in 1051. Is that right? Yeah. Okay, so there.
Did you chart this?
I did. These are the geeky things that Mike does for your benefit. So he is about 70 when he gets, Samuel's about 70 when Saul gets anointed king, I should say. Too many he's in that sentence. He's a young man, 21 years old as he begins his reign. And as we see him in Jabesh Gilead, that last chapter, this is the first year of his reign. Now this next chapter, you see we've fast-forwarded a number of years into Saul's reign. Okay, so we're talking what? 17 years now into his reign. So what seems to happen very quickly here in these next stories is not, okay? It's we've just missed a chunk of his reign, okay? So just as you begin to think through that as we're going to deal with the battle with the Philistines and so on and so forth, that is why, okay? So 13 verse 1, we got a problematic text, okay? Somebody read that.
Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and he ruled over Israel 42 years.
All right. Now, if you're reading an ESV, it says nothing like that. Yeah, Joe? I can see the look on your face. You have an ESV. What's it say?
No.
Saul lived for 1 year and then became king.
Saul lived for 1 year and then became king and reigned over Israel. What are your ESV? 2 years is what the ESV says. Okay. The Hebrew literally reads like this. Saul was blank.
40 years.
There's no number in the Hebrew. It got dropped. Years old when he began to reign, and he reigned blank. And 2 years over Israel. So the question is this a summary statement of Saul's entire reign over Israel? Or is this a couple years in and now they're sharing the story? We don't know, okay? The Hebrew word, the number at some point in the translation got dropped. So both of those are correct. We could be 2 years into his reign at this point. Or this could be a summary statement of saying Saul's going to reign for 40 years. He was 30 years old when he became king. And then is going to reign for 40 years on the throne, 42 years to be exact. Okay, so regardless, it's not important, but if you're reading two different versions and wondering what the heck, that's what the heck, okay?
Thanks, Mike.
So you're welcome. More Excel spreadsheets from Uncle Mikey. Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, which were with Saul at Michmash in the hill country of Bethel. 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin. He sent them away to the rest of the people, each to his own tent. Okay, here is our beginnings of Jonathan, Saul's son. Let's learn about him. Verse 3, somebody read that.
Wait, what leftover men he counted for the 3,000? I'm lost.
Some of them go with Jonathan there, apparently, so... I made this whole. I can't remember where it says it. Just trust me. He's a son. Trust me, Katie. It's fine. Keep reading.
Verse 3.
Sure.
Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba.
Yep.
And the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard it, said that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become a stench to the Philistines, and the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal.
So what's Jonathan's role early on? What do you see him doing when we're introduced to him? Yeah, he's like Saul's lieutenant, commander, something of the army, right? He's a battle-hardened guy. How old would you guess that he is at this point?
In his 30s, 40s.
Yeah, he's probably, well, at this point, he's probably in his young 20s, so says my chart, okay? So I know the answer to the question. My point is he's not a young guy. So when we meet him, not young, David is born during the beginning of Saul's reign. Jonathan on here, as we meet him, is already an older guy, okay, probably in his young 20s. So I just want you to think through that the nature of this relationship that we're going to see between David and Jonathan This isn't a peer relationship. This isn't two young men hanging out together. This is an older guy and a younger guy. And that's important for what we're going to see between their relationship, okay? Ron Allen taught me all this, okay? So, now, just as a reminder, okay, I want you guys to look down here if you can see it. You guys remember our geographical areas of Israel, the coastal plains over here, the Shephelah that ran this way, the hill country, and then the wilderness, right? We had those four kind of distinct areas. Philistines live here. The Judah Mountains is where the people of God live, and the Shephelah has historically been where the battles take place, okay? Now, where are we? Is we're talking about... That's not the one I want. That's the one I want. Turn that way. More bigger-er. Okay? We're talking about this battle that's occurring that may be actually too big, okay? Okay, so here is Jerusalem, by the way. Look where this battle is occurring with the Philistines. This is just north of Jerusalem, okay? What does that tell you about what's been happening during Saul's reign as king? He is losing a ton of land, okay? We just read about the Amorites over here, okay? Jabesh-Gilead is this town right there. The Amorites are attacking. They're pushing the people on the east side of the Jordan west into the Jordan River. We're about to find out that some of the people that are in battle with Saul are abandoning camp and crossing over the Jordan. Their territory is doing this quickly on both sides. The Philistines on the west, the Amorites, the Moabites on the east side of the Jordan. This is a sign of a bigger spiritual condition that's happening. Are you with me? So as you guys are seeing these towns that, you know, probably historically, just like to you or to me, meant nothing to you, that's part of what's going on, okay? So they go out to battle. Verse 6, we're going to see some initial good stuff. The men of Israel saw that they were in a strait. Verse 6, the people were hard-pressed. The people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and cellars and pits. This is bad. This is not what you want to see into this time, okay? Also, verse 7, the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. But as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal. Okay, Gilgal is, where is it on this map? It's somewhere right in this area. Somewhere here. Okay, Michmash, Gilgal's here, okay? Gilgal was the town, by the way, that when Joshua crossed the Jordan River, they set up shop there. That was the first stop over the Jordan River. So they're being pushed back all the way up into the Rift Valley, okay? This is a bad, bad day. Never have we seen Israel with such little land during the period from Joshua and even moving forward into David and Solomon. We're never going to see this again, okay? Bad time, okay? People are deserting him. Now, in verse 8, watch what happens.
He waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal. And the people were scattering from him, so Saul said, "Bring the burnt offering here to me and the peace offerings." He offered the burnt offering as soon as he had finished the offering of burnt offering.
Pause right there for just a second, okay? So Saul is going into battle, and who's he waiting for to show up? Samuel. What is Samuel supposed to do, according to the text? He's going to make offerings for, on behalf of Israel and Saul, to the Lord, right? So Saul's at least got his lucky rabbit's foot of God that he's trying to make offerings to. But what happens? Somehow it looks like Samuel's delayed. They had an agreement, and we see the same agreement way back in chapter 10 where Samuel says, "Wait for me at Gilgal, I'm going to offer sacrifices." This was probably 2 years previous to that, according to the text and the chronological flow. So that text in 1 Sam probably isn't referring to this. But the idea is, Saul is impatient. He's waiting on Samuel to show up. "Dude, we had an agreement. We said 7 days. You're not here. We're getting squeezed from every direction, and I know I need God's blessing to go into battle. What do you do?" Right? So what does Samuel do? Give me the sacrifices, man. Some are the wrong ways better than no way, so we're at least going to worship God or try to offer to him to get his favor so we don't keep getting spanked in battle. And again, they are in a bad spot. And as soon as he offers the burnt offering and the peace offering, look who shows up. Samuel rolls in. Now, what's the problem with that, by the way? Why is Saul not okay to do that?
He's not a priest.
He's not a priest. And by the way, neither is Samuel, but apparently that's okay. So y'all figure that one out. I don't have the answer to that. But as a prophet or God's anointed, and I guess being with the priest and Eli, it's a different whatever. He's not a Levite, but God gives him the green light there. But that role of priest and king, God doesn't want that blurred, okay? That only gets blurred with Jesus when he's the perfect of both. So Samuel rolls in, and in verse 11, Samuel says, "What have you done?" And Saul said, now I want you to listen to this. I want you to think honestly how you would have responded in the situation. You talk about pragmatism and just rational thought. Man, this makes sense to me. Somebody read verse 11, Saul's response to Samuel.
"When I saw that the men were scattered and that you did not come at the set time, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash."
All right, stop right there. He gives them three reasons why he does this. "I saw the people were scattered from me," right? We're in a very, very bad situation. Okay, it's getting worse. I got people deserting me at this point, crossing over the Jordan River. Okay, "and you did not come during the appointed time. We had an agreement. You were late. I told you to be here in 7 days. You were late." Okay, so that's an issue. And then thirdly, the Philistines are assembling at Michmash. They are right next door. Michmash is here. Okay, thank you. So in this area, Gilgal is here. So they have conquered the Shephelah. They are pressing into the Judah Mountains. We got people hiding in cliffs, in caves at this point. Saul's dead to rights, man. He's got nothing. So he says, man, this is just, what other option did I have? Therefore, verse 12, keep reading.
"I thought, now that the Philistines will come down against me in Gilgal, I have not sought the Lord's favor, so I felt compelled to offer burnt offering."
My text is, so I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. Like, I didn't want to do this. I knew this wasn't what God desired, but what other option did I have, right? You take this picture. Do you guys remember the story of Samuel when the Philistines are coming and he offers this weak suckling lamb and the Philistines are like right on their doorstep? And what do the people cry out and say to Samuel during that moment? Do you remember that story? "Don't stop offering sacrifices for us." The idea is, Samuel, we could go fight, but that's not the right move at this point. Pray. And Samuel offers sacrifices for us. And God shows up and completely wrecks shop in the Philistine camp on his own. Okay, Saul is in the same type of situation where they are on the brink of defeat as a nation, and he doesn't know what to do. In pragmatism and practical, as he's looking around with his eyes, this is the situation, and he works and makes decisions based on what he sees, right? And it's very, as I look at that, I go, yeah, that makes complete sense to me. I don't know that I would have made a different decision than Saul did. Like, that makes perfect sense to me. I need God's blessing. This is the only way to get it. Samuel, you're not here. We don't have time. Give me the sacrifice. This isn't my favorite, but let's get it done, okay? Samuel, verse 13, now says this to him.
"You have done a foolish thing. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God that he gave you. If you had, you would have been established in your kingdom over Israel for all time."
Ouch. So what is Samuel's basically saying? Keep rolling 14.
"But now your kingdom will not endure, and the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler over his people because you have not kept the Lord's command."
That's a pretty stern response. I mean, this is the first, like, oops that we see in Saul's reign. And again, we're into it a bit, and it's going to keep, you know, unfolding. But what's Samuel's ultimate point of this? What's he saying to Saul?
Should have helped him out when he had the chance.
Kinda. Disobedient. And what's the end result of his disobedience? You're not going to be king. Dude, you're done. You're done. And not just you. What does it mean? The Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. You would have had a dynasty. You could have had your sons and your sons' sons ruling from this seat. And your choice, your bad decision as king, has now erased that. God said in chapter 12, I would have blessed this. It wasn't the best, but I would have made it work. And you blew it. You did something you knew better than to do by offering sacrifices. You're the king. You're not the priest. It's not your job. We're done. That's like Moses-esque in terms of, like, golly, all I did one time was smack the rock. And God says, you're done. You're on the bench. You're not going to the promised land. You have failed to treat me as holy. You're done. So it's a very stern response from God, but welcome to the perils of leadership, right? I mean, that's, he's leading a nation.
I don't mean to side with Saul on this one, but doesn't David do the same thing?
How so?
Doesn't David offer sacrifices?
He'll dance before the Lord. He puts on the linen ephod. There are certainly things that he does that bleed into that role of priest that are a little bit odd at times. I'm trying to remember if he actually offers sacrifice. I can't remember. I don't think like this. Apparently what Saul did was different. That's my only understanding. But there are certainly things that David does in this realm that you go, huh.
Well, I could see that at least the heart of Saul is all about him.
Yeah.
And that, just like you said, this is your lucky rabbit's foot act.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so much of, I mean, I'd have to add to the text to say so, but you don't see Saul offering the sacrifice and then giving it to the Lord and saying, hey, Lord, let this be your will, you know, yeah. work through us, you know, yeah. mobilize your people. You don't see that added in the text.
Yeah.
You just see that he does
yeah.
a pragmatic
yeah.
act.
Why would God do this, by the way? This is a mirror image, almost, right, of what happened to Samuel early on in his reign. And then the same situation, similar situation, happens in Saul's reign. And we see two very different responses in these two men. What's the point of this?
I think it's his heart.
Yeah.
Saul's heart. He sees what Saul will do, his dynasty, his kid, what he'll instill in his kid.
What's Saul trusting in ultimately?
Himself.
Himself. And his ability or his army or his whatever. God is he's a sideshow. He's a side act. And I know it's good to have his blessing, but he's not the main show. I am the main show. Samuel, on the other hand, says, man, look, if I don't keep offering sacrifices, we're all dead. I don't care if you all pick up your sword and go fight the Philistines. It doesn't matter. God is the one that's in charge, and God shows up in a miraculous way. So God has literally set the table with Saul to say, how are you going to respond when you are at the end of your rope and then some? When there is no way that your kingly abilities, resources, armies, weapons can save the day. What are you going to do? Are you going to lean on me? By the way, where's the ark? By the way, where's the tabernacle? And not with Saul. He doesn't even care about them. They're gone. We're going to see a mention of the ark here in a minute in chapter 14. It's the only blip on the radar in 40 years of Saul's reign where he even thinks about it. And he probably isn't even talking about the ark. It's weird.
Well, I think you could see, at least within the scripture, that you have this mentality of desperate, and like I had, you know, he gave his reasoning,
mm-hmm.
but then you have this like, I want to say crescendo, if you're looking at him in a cinematic movie,
mm-hmm.
of wisdom.
Yeah.
Samuel comes in and he's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
This isn't how you do it. I don't
yeah.
care what you think this mm-hmm. should be done. Like,
yep.
this is disobeying God.
Yep.
Like, so you're going to go in sword to sword, or are you going to follow God? Like, which one? And so
yep.
you just see like this essence of wisdom.
Yep. yep. And you got a guy preaching this to Samuel, or to Saul rather, in Samuel, who's been there and who's done that, right? Who had to make the same choice, and he chose God. He did not choose to do that. So this is, in a lot of ways, man, we've just crested the hill with Saul, and now we're on the downhill side of the roller coaster, and it's going to go down quick, fast, in a hurry, okay? So let's keep going, but this is the end of it all, okay? Samuel has just now told Saul, you're done, and Samuel rose, went from Gilgal to Gibeah. By the way, 14, what does God say in the midst of that? We haven't talked about that. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart. Who are we speaking of here? This is David, okay? This is the guy that God says, man, when you chose, by the way, how did Israel choose Saul? With their eyes. And God says, I'm going to choose a guy for his heart, not his externals. He's not going to look the part of a king. He's going to be completely different than Saul. And thankfully so, okay? Now, the battle's going to continue. They arose, verse 15, went out from Gilgal, about 600 men. Saul and his son Jonathan and the people were present, okay? There's battles going back and forth. This Philistine-Israel battle continues to occur. By the way, it is so bad in verse 19. Listen to this in terms of your warfare strategy. Tiana, read that in 19.
Otherwise, the Hebrews will make
So you kind of need a blacksmith if you're going to have a sword or a spear or a something to fight with, right? There are none in Israel. The idea is this is the end of the Bronze Age, beginning of the Iron Age. The Philistines are eons ahead in terms of technology, battle-hardened stuff. They come from Crete. They have all the new weapons, the chariots, right? So they are far outmatched, the Israelites are, and they have to pay literally an arm and a leg, right? They had to go into to land a Philistine to get their sword sharpened, and they got charged a ton of cash to do that. So you get a little bit more of that in the end of 13, of just the desperation that the Philistines are under. And in 22, we find out neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, except Saul and Jonathan. Like, these guys are fighting, like, old school days, Shamgar, like, with an ox goad. Like, what do you got in your barn? Great, we'll fight with that. I mean, it's just a desperate bad day. And you see how bad the situation is with the land, with the conditions and all this. It's a bad, bad time, okay? Now, chapter 14, we're going to focus in now on Jonathan and his story. Let's pick up there. So now do you believe it because the Bible said it, Katie? Yeah. Okay, all right, good. Uncle Mikey's word isn't good enough.
But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave at Migron.
All right, so we find out Jonathan's going to leave with his armor bearer, leaves camp, doesn't tell his dad. Okay, this is like a midnight raid, and he's just going, he and this other guy, super stealth, and they're going to go attack or kind of find out, basically get information from the Philistines. We find out in verse 3, Ahijah is the current high priest in the day, so remember his name, we're going to see him later. You get a lineage here, son of Ahiatub, Derek, you're welcome, I'm not going to make you read all this, son of Ichabod, or Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the priest of the Lord at Shiloh. So Ahijah is the high priest. Jonathan did not know, Saul did not know, and the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. So they kind of go SEAL Team 6 this thing, and they come in verse up to the camp of the Philistines, and Jonathan says this now in verse 6, Katie, keep reading.
Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of Ephraim circumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few.
What do you see in this guy initially, by the way? Jonathan's awesome. He's a battle-hardened guy, and he loves the Lord, right? He realizes the key to victory is God. Like, hey, let's go do this. I know we're outmatched. I know the situation is desperate, but man, God saved by few before. He's probably thinking of Gideon and the 300 and other situations where God has shown up, where numbers and lopsided battles, man, it doesn't matter to God. God can do whatever he wants. So you see some really cool qualities in Jonathan, by the way. He's one of the unsung heroes of Scripture. By the way, this dude would have made an awesome king. Saul, he's got a good start, but he flounders. But because of Saul's actions, by the way, who doesn't get to be king? Any from his line. And Jonathan would have been the firstborn. He would have been the guy that would have been in line. And Jonathan would have been absolutely amazing for all the qualities that you see in him. He's amazing. His armor bearer said to him, man, let's do this. Verse 7, we're on. Yep.
Constantly seeing the good side of Saul, even though he makes some poor decisions. If Jonathan is his son, I mean, it kind of shows that, like, Saul was not altogether a terrible father.
No, he's not awful. He's just got a...
He's got a son that seems to follow the Lord well.
Yeah, he's got a divided heart, and that's it with Saul. And and over time, it's going to get slowly... it's just going to slowly move to pragmatism, and God's just going to fall off the radar. And as it gets to the end of his life, man, he's going to punt all the things of God. So, yeah, I mean, Saul's got a great dad, and Kish, you see his upbringing. The Lord is certainly spoken of in their home, but he's a terrible leader when it comes down to it. We're going to see some qualities here in a second that are just like, it's just, he had too much spotlight. He had too much above the waterline and didn't have enough below the waterline to sustain himself. So, yeah. Jonathan says now in verse 8, read this. This is cool.
Then Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over to the men and we will show ourselves to them. If they say to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and we will not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hand.
So there's two of them, and they're coming to a garrison of Philistines, and they're going to say, hey, we're just going to reveal ourselves to them. Hey, guys, we're not hiding anymore. Here we are, both of us. Like, dude, that is a gutsy move, right? That's strategically not the smartest. But they said, look, if these guys say, hey, stay there, we'll come to you, then we know we're host. If they say, no, 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 come on up to us, then they'll know we're going to, that's John, for whatever reason, God has either revealed this to him, or this is how he hopes that God's going to work. So that's what they do. They walk over to the Philistine garrison. They say, hey, here we are. The men of the garrison in verse 12 hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us, and we will tell you something. So this was the good side of that plan. So God said, or Jonathan says, man, if this is how it unfolds, then we're going to get victory this day. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me. The Lord has given them into our hands. Has given. Like, it's done. Okay, Jonathan climbed up on his hands and his feet. His armor bearer in, verse 13. Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet with his armor bearer behind him, and they fell before Jonathan, and the armor bearer put some of them to death. So they kill some of these men. Verse 14. Sean, pick up there and read.
Which verse?
14.
And that first strike which Jonathan and his armor bearer made killed about 20 men within, as it were half a furrow's length in an acre of land.
So the idea is they're handling an area that is beyond the scope of what they should be able to do in terms of square footage, right? Now, watch what else happens in 15 and why this battle's victorious.
And there was a panic in the camp, in the field, and among the people. The garrison and even the raiders trembled. The earth quaked, and it became a very great panic.
And the earth quaked. What do you call that? It's an earthquake from the Lord, right? In the middle of this battle, people are panicking. So same as before we saw with Samuel, the Philistines are killing one another, right? So God shows up just as Jonathan predicted would happen, and they win this battle. It's amazing. Now, it's two guys, Jonathan and his armor bearer. That's it.
What is it? The armor bearer is the guy that carries the armor.
Carries your shield.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go, okay?
Jonathan doesn't have a shield on, he's whacking people.
He's smacking people down, so no. That was your armor bearer. That's what it means, okay? We carry your stuff in a battle, okay? Saul's watchman in verse 16, now back to Saul's story. Looked in, and behold, the multitude had melted away. Verse 17, Saul said to the people who were with them, number us, and somebody's gone. I can't figure it out. And they numbered him and realized Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So remember, Jonathan did not tell his pops he was leaving. So Saul says now to Ahijah, the high priest, bring the ark of God here, for the ark of God at that time was with the sons of Israel. Okay, anybody got a different word for ark in verse 18? Somebody should. What's that?
The
ephod. Okay. The Septuagint translation in the Hebrew says ephod, and other translations say ark. Okay. More than likely, it's probably supposed to be ephod. So the priest is there, Ahijah's there, they're nearby in kind of their home camp, and Saul says, man, bring the priest here. I think what he's after is the Urim and Thummim. Roll the dice and tell us what the will of God is here. Unlikely that it's the ark. So this is the only potential place in the 40-year reign of Saul where we even see the ark mentioned, and it's probably not the ark. Okay, so he's probably asking, priest, come in here and tell me what the heck I'm supposed to do, right? How am I supposed to do this? Now, 19, typical Saul, Joe, read that.
Now Saul was talking to the priest with the tumult in the Philistines' camp. The priest more and more, so Saul said to the priest, draw your hand.
So he invites the priest in to come roll the Urim and Thummim or whatever it is. Then all of a sudden the Philistines start coming in, and what does he do again? What does that mean, withdraw your hand? He says to the priest. We got other things to do, man. The Philistines are coming. Stop your spiritual mumbo-jumbo. Get out of here. This is not helpful. Now, so you're seeing this theme with Saul, right? When push comes to shove, who does he trust in?
Himself.
Not God. Definitely himself or the situation or whatever it is. And this is what is at the heart of his poor leadership. There's just simply a lack of trust with Saul. Like when he needs something to happen, it's not God who ultimately is going to get it done. Withdraw your hand. Saul said to the people who were with them, rally, every man's sword was against his fellow. Verse 20, there's great confusion. The Hebrews who were with the Philistines previously went up with them. There's this battle that takes place. 23, though, the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth-Aven. So God is still present, working, but verse 24, the men of Israel were hard-pressed on that day. They win this initial battle, and now Saul's going to make a vow to say, man, I'm going to get vengeance. These Philistines have encroached on our territory, and in verse 24, he says, cursed be the man who eats food before evening, until I have avenged myself on my enemies. None of the people tasted food. He says, basically, this battle ain't done. We've got the Philistines on their heels because God showed up. No one's going to stop for a lunch break. We're going to go do battle. And if anybody eats until I've avenged myself, by the way, not the Lord himself, you're a dead man. Okay, so you can see Saul's leadership is getting a little bit rank and weird in this whole situation. But the people obey. Now, Jonathan, his armor bearer, gone. They don't hear. They don't hear this edict from Saul. So they obviously have no idea that Saul's ordered this. Okay, it says that in verse 27. The people are under the oath. He doesn't know. But in 26, now watch what Jonathan does.
They had gone into the woods. They saw the honey oozing out.
There was a flow of honey, and no man put his hand to his mouth. Nobody tasted the honey because of fear of the oath. However, 27, Jonathan hadn't heard about this, so he eats some honey, right? Yeah. Honey would, you know, sugar, give you at least some, right, crank up your ability to, like, it would enlighten you for a little bit, right? And then you sugar crash afterwards after you use Snickers bar. But that's the idea. At least it's been something that would have been good for them to go do battle, okay? Then someone says to Jonathan in 28, bro, you weren't supposed to do that. That was a big no-no in verse 28. And Jonathan says now in verse 29 about his father's leadership. Read that. This is a fascinating picture of Jonathan's assessment of Saul.
My father has made trouble for the country. See how my eyes brighten when I tasted a little of this honey. How much better would it be if the men had eaten today some of the plunder they had took from their enemies? Would not the slaughter of the Philistines have been greater?
Isn't that great? Like, he's like, man, this is a bad leadership decision on my dad's part. Had he let the whole camp eat, what would have happened? Everybody's revived. Everybody's re-energized. They took a break, right? Jonathan says, this is bad leadership on my dad's part. So again, you see this idea that Jonathan's concerned about the people. Saul is using the people, and there's a big difference in the two. So he would have had, again, this great heart to be king, and that's part of the neat story of Jonathan as we move into it with David. He would have been great, and he loves the people, and the people love him. They struck the Philistines in verse 31. Israel wins the battle, okay, even though they're weary. In 32, watch what happens. Emily, pick up there. Whoa. Hello, Leviticus. So we've rolled in now to the town. We've killed the Philistines, and now we're taking their stuff. And how do they eat it? How hungry are you, honestly, when you're eating raw sheep, whatever? Like, man, I don't know that I've ever been that hungry in my life. I've been pretty desperate for a pizza before, but like that's a whole interesting deal, okay? Then Saul said, behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. They told this to Saul in verse 33. You have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone of, that's what Gilgal means, a stone of reproach. This is a bad deal. But Saul has caused this. He's put his people in this situation where they're acting literally out of desperation. We don't have time to cook it. Eat it and let's be done with it. Saul says, disperse yourselves, bring your sheep and stuff to me. Do not sin against the Lord in verse 34 by eating with the blood in it. This is a bad deal. They brought each ox, they slaughtered it there. Saul built an altar to the Lord in verse 35. It was the first altar that he had built to the Lord. We're halfway through Saul's career almost at the end of this season, chapter 14. It's the first altar he's built to the Lord. So bad day for Saul, okay? So we're seeing this, just qualities in him, qualities in Jonathan that are juxtaposed, and the sin that he's causing. Now, verse 36, let's pick up on the rest of the story with the eating of the honey. 36.
Then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. Let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." But the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." And Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him that day.
Hmm. So what are we seeing with the relationship between Saul and God at this point? God shut it off, man. I left the building, right? This is similar to Samson, who did not know that the Lord had left him, right? So God's hand of blessing is off Saul at this point in some regard. Saul said, "Draw near, hear all you chiefs of your people, investigate and see how the sin happened today." Saul can't figure out why God isn't blessing him, so he's trying to figure out why he won't speak to him. So at least he's trying to fix the situation, if you will. And then Saul's going to make another rash vow. The first rash vow was, man, whoever eats honey, man, this is, or you're going to march all night, no eating. Okay, verse 39, he's going to make another rash vow. Read this one. 39. Yep, 39.
"For as the Lord lives, who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die."
So Saul's realized, someone, I made a vow, someone has eaten honey against what I said, and I don't care if it's my son Jonathan, he's dead. I don't care who this is. So he's saying, even if it's my son, we'll take his life for the sake of God being back on our team. Okay, and they find out, lo and behold, it's Jonathan who's eating the honey. So they cast lots to get all the way down to Jonathan. Verse 41, Jonathan and Saul were taken, and the people escaped. Cast lots now between Jonathan and Saul, and they find out Jonathan was the one that ate the honey. Look at Jonathan's response in verse 43. Derek, pick up there.
"Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. And Jonathan told him, I tasted a little honey with the tip of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am, I will die."
Wow. So remember, did Jonathan hear this edict from Saul? No. Why? Because he was gone spanking a bunch of Philistines because his dad was too much of a sissy to go out and battle himself. Jonathan does it, right? So he hears about it later and realizes, man, retroactively I sinned, but I don't even know, right? It's like when you're speeding and they put up a... There's no speed limit sign. Then they put it up later and say, oh, yeah, well, we talked about it last week. We just forgot to put up the sign, and now you're guilty, and the punishment's death. He's like, well, that seems hardly fair, but Jonathan says what? Right. Great. Clearly God's hand of blessings off of us. I ate the honey. I got to die. Like, that's, wow. I mean, you talk about manning up and just owning it. There's no excuses. He says, I did it. I'm the cause. Kill me. Okay? And Saul said, verse 44,
"God, do so to me and more also. You shall surely die."
Okay. So what's Saul say?
Okay.
Yep, you're dead. Tell you a little bit about that relationship. Like, this is odd. Like, you just see the rashness in Saul. Like, yeah, that's what he said, but buddy, take a break. Eat a Snickers. Do something to get your thoughts right. Like, something's off here with Saul. He's so rash in the way he's making decisions. Watch what happens in verse 45. Jonathan obviously doesn't die here. Look who saves him.
"Then the people said to Saul, should Jonathan die, who has worked his great salvation in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground. For he has worked with God this day." So the people ransomed Jonathan so that he did not die.
Who rescued Jonathan? The people. Man, that's great. There's a beautiful picture here, by the way, of the leader that has the title of leader and the guy that doesn't. Who's the recognized leader here? Jonathan. He doesn't have the title. He doesn't have the position. He doesn't have the office. He has the respect of the people. Saul is leader by force because he can take lives. There can be consequences if you don't obey them. Two very, very different leadership styles. Saul's leadership style is effective in some way, right? People don't respect you. They don't like you. But because you're forced to work for them, okay. I mean, you can. You can lead that way if you want to. But nobody underneath you, none of your followers like you. Jonathan leads a very different way, right? Respect of the people. He's courageous. He's a godly man. And ultimately, those are the guys that rescue him because they respect him. It's a beautiful picture of this contrast in leadership styles. Again, from the same family. This is father and son. The people rescue him, and Saul basically says, great, I'm okay with that. So they return to their own place, it's all good, okay? 47 and following, you just kind of get some ditties on, like, the condition of Israel during this time. When Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, in verse 47, he fought against all his enemies, every side, Moab, Amnon, Edom, the Philistines, wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. There is no peace in the land. He's fighting battles on every side. He acted valiantly, delivered the people from the Amalekites, delivered them from the hands of those that plundered him. So he's doing a good job as king. He's at least trying to defend his nation. But man, there is uproar and upheaval all around him. So it's not a good situation. Okay, he acted valiantly, which is kudos again to Saul. He's got some great qualities about him, but he's failing on the spiritual end of the stick, if you will. Okay, Saul has some sons here in verse 49. Jonathan, some of the other ones are mentioned. Michael is mentioned, his daughter at the end of verse 49. She'll be important later in David's life. So his daughter Michael is mentioned there. Michael, yep, that's her name. M-I-C-H-A-L. So it's a chick's name. Shannon Michael, how you like that? I got two chick's names. So there you go. Okay, Saul's wife is mentioned here in verse 50, and we get a bit more of the lineage of Saul. And in 52, the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. When Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. So as soon as Saul finds folks that can help him win battles and win the day, he's bringing them onto his staff. But the condition of the land, which again is an indicator of the spiritual temperature of what's going on and who's winning what, is bad. Okay, so Saul's losing land and losing ground to all the pagan nations around them. Okay, so we are seeing Joshua's incomplete conquest. Not Joshua, but the peoples, the consequences thereof, now hundreds of years later, here in the book of 1 Samuel. Okay? All right. Chapter 15, okay? This is kind of the end-all, be-all, if you will. This is where it gets ugly. Okay? 15:1, let's pick up there.
And Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people Israel. Now therefore listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both men and women, child and infant, oxen, sheep, camel, and donkey."
All right, now this is a weird story, okay? God says to Saul, "I remember Amalek, the Amalekites, and what they did to Israel when?" Verse 2. When they were coming out of Egypt. Gang, this was 400 years ago. And God says to Saul, "I am done now with the Amalekites. I have been long-suffering, patient, and gracious with the Amalekites. You are going to be my instrument, Saul, to deal with them." Now, anybody remember what they did to Israel?
Is it that they wouldn't let them pass?
Too long.
Not them. That was the Edomites and the Moabites. Close. Okay. Turn to Deuteronomy 25 real quick, and I just want you guys to remember the story as to why God would say, "Hey, don't just kill the men, kill the women, kill the children, their sheep, their oxen, everything." Deuteronomy 25. Starting in verse 17, read through the end of the chapter, 17 through 19.
"Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt, how he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary, and cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind you, as he did not fear God."
So you were leaving Egypt, you're faint, you're weary, you're hungry, you're thirsty, you're weak. And then the king of the Amalekites decides that he's going to attack you. And where does he attack? The stragglers in the back. The women and the children.
He says 17.
Yeah, that's 18, okay? And then he says, therefore, in verse 19, when you have rest for your enemies, God is going to, at the end of verse 19, blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget. So this guy takes down Israel's women and children. when they're weak and weary and have no defenses. So this guy is a dirty turd, is what we call him. Okay, no likey. So for whatever reason, God says, I'm going to let this clan live for another 400 years, and then they're done. Okay, and for whatever reason, Saul is going to be the vehicle to execute God's judgment. So why God does this now, we don't know, but this is Saul's job. Okay, he's told by Samuel, man, this is from the Lord, go make it happen. Okay, so Saul is obedient. He summons in verse 4, 2,000 foot soldiers, 10,000 men of Judah. They go to battle. They depart, and they destroy them. He tells the people the story in verse 6. Verse 7, Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. So he captures the king and does exactly what God told him to do, or what Samuel told him to do through the voice of God. Okay, but verse 19, sorry, 9, what happens? Somebody read 9.
But Saul and the army spared Agag, and the best of the sheep, and the cattle, and the fat calves, and the lambs, and everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed.
So what was God's command?
Everything.
It's all tied to me, right? The sheep, the oxen, everything. You're going to destroy everything. What does Saul keep?
The good stuff.
Treasure.
Specifically, the spoil of the battle, right? And what else? The king. Talk to me. Why is Saul keeping Agag the king? Why would he do that? Think like a king.
For the better of his sources and for the accomplishment.
No.
Isn't there a story?
A what?
Trophy.
A trophy. Okay. What's it? It took you a while. It took a long way down. So what's he going to do with Agag? Another dude. Yeah, that was in Judges. Yeah, but that would be the idea. You can humiliate kings by cutting off their thumbs or their toes. We saw that guy in the book of Judges. There was another king that got destroyed. But you're going to parade him around, right? Here's the king. Put him in fetters. March around your city. Whatever it is, but he is a trophy of your victory, right? So Samuel shows up in verse 10. And boy, if this is not just some strong language.
I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments.
Wow. When's the last time that we've heard God say, I regret something? I am sorry was the word that we saw used. It's Genesis 6. Like, I am so deeply pained by Saul's actions and how far he has come the wrong way. That I regret that I made him king. Like, this is awful. But this is what the people asked for. That's what Saul's name means, asked for. So there you go. Samuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night. So how does Samuel respond, by the way, when he hears God's grief? Man, he's upset. He grieves with them. What is he doing, by the way? What would you guess? Crying out to the Lord all night. What is he crying out to the Lord about? Probably praying for Saul, this wicked leader, right? And probably praying, God, you said something about a man for your own heart. Hurry up and bring that dude, right? It's a rough picture. So, anyway, continue on now. Verse 12. Jimmy, pick up there.
Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, and it was told Samuel, saying, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself, then turned and proceeded on down to Gilgal.
So he's won this battle. Now he sets his own, like, he's making trophies for himself, which is funny, but it's telling you more about Saul. Okay, Samuel now comes to Saul, and Saul says to him, blessed are you of the Lord. I have carried out the command of the Lord. This is what he tells to Samuel. And Samuel says then, this would be, it's in a movie somewhere. I forget who did it, but this is it would be a great movie scene. Listen to Samuel's response in verse 14. Troy, read that.
Verse
14.
And Samuel said, what then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen that I hear?
So Saul says, I've been 100% obedient. And Samuel says, yeah, but I hear sheep I hear lowing of oxen. So Samuel says, you have not been obedient, right? That's a just a great line. Saul says now in verse 15, this, listen to this godly leadership who accepts responsibility for his actions. Troy, keep rolling. 15.
Saul said they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have devoted to destruction.
Verse 15, they have brought them from the Amalekites. Whoa, whoa, Samuel, this isn't my fault. It's the people's fault. They brought all this stuff, and then he spins it. What are we going to do with it, though? We're going to offer sacrifices to God, right? That was my intention the whole time. So he doesn't own it, doesn't take responsibility, points a finger at the people, and then tries to spin it and say, but this is really a godly thing, right? Verse 16.
Enough!
Then Samuel said to Saul, stop. I will tell you what the Lord said to me this night. And he said to him, speak. And Samuel said, though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel. The Lord sent you on a mission and said, go, devote to destruction the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord?
That's good. So 17, what does that mean? Is it not true, though you were little in your own eyes, you were made head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king? You were a nobody, and that's what God wanted. You were a humble Benjamite, least and last, a son of Kish, looking for your donkeys. That's the king that I needed, that was humble, independent, and not big in his own eyes, and God made you king. And now, as we say in Texas, you're too big for your britches. Man, you've read too much of your own press. You're a big deal in your own eyes. And that's not what God wants, right? Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Verse 19, you did not do what I asked you to do, what the Lord asked you to do. And now you're giving me a boatload of excuses. And in 20, Saul's not done. Keep going, Troy.
20, and then Saul said to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me. I have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and I have devoted the Amalekites to destruction. The people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God.
Like, man, do you think you're going to win this battle with God and with Samuel by being defensive and giving him the list of things that you have done? Like, he just won't, he won't humble himself and won't, like, gosh, man, I see this in me all the time in arguments, right? When I get pushed or feel like I get pushed back into a corner, I come out defensive. I come out with my fist verbally. Like, I want to defend myself. I want to be right. I want to win. And Saul's the same way. Just won't be humble and say, Samuel, you're right. Maybe I did 99% of what God asked me to do, but I didn't finish the job. I wasn't wholeheartedly obedient. And the problem isn't necessarily what percentage he did. The problem is what that's rooted to. It's pride, so that he can exalt himself, so he can build a monument. He can show everybody, look at Agag, who I've defeated. Let me take some of the spoil from the battle so I can become richer or whatever. So it's, yeah, he did a lot right, but he didn't do it all right. And it's ultimately a heart issue. And what does God say about the next king? He's going to have my heart. He's not going to have this problem. So it's a beautiful picture of Saul's, where the cracks are in his armor, if you will. So he tries again to convince Samuel that, man, I've done this right and I've been obedient, but Samuel ain't having it, okay? 22 now. Boy, this is hard. Keep reading, Troy.
And Samuel says, has the Lord... Now, this is that coffee cup, bro. This is why I tell my wife all the time. Better obey, right? And Samuel said, As the Lord has granted offerings and sacrifices, as in obeying the voice of the Lord, behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. 23. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king.
Boy, that's a sting. What does that mean in 22? Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord.
Those things are means to ultimately obeying the Lord.
Yeah. Is God more delighted that you're checking all the religious boxes, that you're going through the motions, or that you're obeying? God didn't ask for altars today, or burnt offerings, or sacrifices. He asked you to obey him and to slaughter the Amalekites. That was his will for you today. And Saul tried to spin this and make it about him. And then in verse 23, you get the idea. Rebellion, meaning not obeying God, is the same as the sin of divination. What is divination? We saw that word in Egypt. It's worshiping a false god. Like, whoa, isn't that worse? Bowing down to Baal or Asherah or an Egyptian god? Are you saying that's worse than a simple, like, in 23, rebellion, like a small disobedience on my part? God says, they're the same, because the heart issue is still wicked. Insubordination, meaning not following through with your boss's order, is the same as iniquity and idolatry. Saul's trying to, like, pit his sin against other people's sin and say, I'm not that bad. And God says, man, you don't get it. Your heart is wicked. You won't follow me. You won't obey me. This is about you, not about your people, not about these other things. We see in Malachi chapter 1, when the situation gets so bad, this is 1,000 years from now in Israel, 600 years from this point in Israel, 400-ish BC, God says, I wish there were one among you who would shut the gates to the temple, put a padlock on it, and be done with it. I'm tired of your religious externalism, all this, these signs that look spiritual, but on the inside, you're wicked. It'd be better to shut the whole process down than to fake it on the outside and be wretched on the inside. I have no desire of that, right? And what's the ultimate, like, pain of all of this is that is exactly what the Jewish people had become in that day, and in a lot of ways have become even today in some circles, where they check the boxes, they do the religious things, but they lack the heart of God in the process. And not to just throw Jews under the bus, we do it the exact same way as Christians, right? I've been a Christian for 20 years. I can fake it, and you guys would never know it. I've been in the game long enough to know how to bring my Bible to church, to tell everybody everything's fine, right? And if people stay at arm's length from me, man, I can put on a religious show all day long. And my heart can be wicked and evil and sinful in that process if I'm not careful, and so can you. And remember that. God is not concerned about our religious, external, whatever, demonstrations of religion. He cares about our heart. To the point where he says, man, I didn't give you guys Leviticus in this system so that you would check boxes. I gave you the system, as Troy said, it's because it is a means to worship me. But what I want is a contrite heart that loves me, right? And that's what this process is supposed to bring about. They just skipped the process and went to the end goal and said, yeah, okay, God's happy with this today because I offered a pigeon or a ram or whatever, and I've done this thing. But, man, there's no introspection, there's no worship, there's no heart of God. And ultimately, this is what's cracked in Saul, and this is what's been exposed now over his couple decades of reigning in Israel. Okay, so
it's crazy that David says, like, almost the exact thing in that one song. Like, I never just got the connection.
Yeah.
Like, that's really cool.
So, yeah. The question is back to what I was asking you last week. That kind of whole debate thing. Did Saul ever have salvation from the beginning?
I think so. I think he's jacked. And he's going to get, man, Aaron, it's going to get way worse, dude. But we see him in chapter 31. He's going to be worshiping. Worshiping's the wrong word.
Did he kill himself? When it says he fell onto a sword?
Yeah. Yeah. But he's seeking out a witch in Endor at the end of the story. Like, he's trying to find a medium. He is in some weird religious nut job stuff at the end of his life. So, man, I don't know. I wouldn't bet my salvation on Saul's salvation, but I think we'll see him in it. I think we'll see him in heaven. He's just a jacked dude that, man, his heart got pulled in a lot of different directions, and he didn't have the character to walk with the Lord. Okay, now 24. This is what we would hope to see in Saul, kinda. Yeah.
These preceding verses are kind of scary.
Yeah, it's That is not what you want the prophet of God to say to you, right? I mean, you're... 25. Yeah, keep reading.
24, Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord in your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice.
Okay. That's the first honest thing he said. He stopped being defensive and he says, man, I've sinned against the Lord. I have transgressed. Because why? Verse 24. I feared the people. I want you to circle that word in that verse. Feared. Saul's modus operandi, his MO moving forward for the rest of the decisions that he's going to make as king is based on that. Who's he going to fear, by the way, next?
David.
The guy that God is exalting, and he looks at him and says, man, that's not a guy that I need around. He's competing for my job. In the decisions that he's going to make as king, he quits leading Israel, and his main goal is, how do I get rid of that kid? Because he's a threat to me, and he's a fear-based leader. So the decisions that he's going to make are going to come out of fear. You can see where this is going. It's not a good deal, okay? Initial, what appears to be maybe humility, maybe brokenness, maybe repentance. Okay, Troy, keep rolling. Yeah, I think his motives come out here, the rest of this text. It's not legitimate. It sounds like it, but Saul's got a bigger end game here, and it's not just about, I'm repenting. There's something that he wants.
It's interesting that like Romans 3:18 comes to mind, like fear, there was no fear of God before their eyes.
Hmm.
The idea of sinful, but you pointed it out, circling like the fear of man.
Yeah, and that's, you can fear one or the other, but you can't fear both, or you're going to fear one more than the other at the very least, and he's there. Yeah.
Now, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may bow before the Lord.
Okay, so return with me. More on that in a second. Pardon my sin. Samuel says in verse 26 to him, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord and have rejected, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. 27, as Samuel turned to go, Saul seized the edge of his robe and tore it. And Samuel says, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today, and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. And the glory of Israel will not lie or change his mind. Speaking of God, he is not a man that he should change his mind. It's done. And just like you tore my robe, your kingdom has been torn from you. Why, by the way, is there this emphasis on Samuel, return with me to the people?
Make it all look like everything's okay.
Before the people whom I fear, I need your approval to the people so that they still see that I'm the guy. And Samuel says, no, I will not go with you. I am not going to, even in this pseudo-repentance, I'm not going to give you what you want, which ultimately is your leadership position back and the people. He wants them to obey Saul once again. That's the motive. So this fake, I'm crying a little bit, right? I'm repenting. Samuel sees through that and says, no, I will not do that. And he's so desperate for it, he literally grabs Samuel. Samuel's an old man at this point. He's in his 80s, I think. I forget exactly. But he's old. He's going to die soon, right? We've already seen his farewell speech. But he's just hanging on, okay? Verse 30 now, he says, I have sinned, but please honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel, and go back with me that I may worship the Lord your God. Very telling. Good catch, Joe. That's very, very telling where Saul's at. Samuel went back following Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. So there's some sorrow there. There's some repentance there for sure, but it's not. Saul wants the consequences of his sin removed more than he wants to just repent of his sin. Does that make sense? It wasn't enough that he grieved God. It's to the point where now consequences are coming, and he's more concerned about those consequences than he is about grieving the heart of God alone. Okay, I don't know about you guys, but that is a phenomenal barometer of my spiritual life. Am I more concerned in times when I'm in sin and in pursuing whatever idol it is that Mike is pursuing said day, that I've grieved the heart of God and I've damaged that relationship, or am I more concerned about the consequences of my sin when those occur? Sometimes God's gracious enough that there isn't self-inflicted gunshot wounds that I've got to deal with, that I don't have to pay for the consequences of my own sin. But sometimes God allows me to experience the sting of that. So when I put my hand on the stove, it hurts, right? When I am ungracious and speak in a frustrated tone to my kids, like sometimes there's distance between us, and that's the consequence of that until I humble myself and apologize. Sometimes God has to use those consequences to get my attention, to remind me. But man, I think what is better is when outside of consequences, my heart is grieved because I've grieved the heart of my Father, and I want that relationship back. So sometimes God will do this in our lives to say, man, if I can't wake you up just by the sense of that you have damaged this relationship, I'm still your Father, you're still my son, that never will change, but now there is tension between us because of your sin, man, I want to get there, and I want that to grieve me more than the potential loss of accolades or treasures or whatever thing that God could potentially remove from me that would be more valuable to me than him. So for me in my life, man, that's a good gut check for me. What motivates me to repentance? Do I need God to put my hands on the chalkboard and spank me and experience consequences of that? Or can I just say, you know what, Lord, man, I'm an idiot and I blew it today and I am sorry and that's not what I want and I need your forgiveness and I need to walk in that newness of light and That to me is a good thermometer for me. So noodle on that as you guys think about it. Saul has lost that. He's far more concerned about the people, the accolades, the role, the prestige that comes with it than he is with grieving the heart of the Father. Okay. So anyway, now 32. This is this is odd. Okay, and it's a terrible scene, but this is ultimately what God wanted to begin with. Okay. So Samuel goes back, verse 32, Samuel said, bring me Agag, the king of the Amalekites, okay? In my version, 32, it says, Agag came to him cheerfully, and Agag said, surely the bitterness of death is past. Does anybody have a different reading or a different maybe understanding of that text? It's a really weird in the Hebrew.
Haltingly,
okay? So he either came cheerfully, or he came in fetters, meaning in chains. The Hebrews, it's confusing as to what it means, and it's odd that it could mean both. It's like Joseph's name means to add or subtract. Like, well, man, which is it? Those are opposites. So same here. Either he came all happy, thinking, if Saul was going to kill me, it'd be over, so I'm scot-free, and this old fart Samuel, he ain't going to do a dang thing, right? He's got this white robe, whatever. He's acting at least in the role of a priest. I'm good to go. Or he came in fetters and has said now comes bitter death. So it's either cheerful saying death is past or in chains saying I'm about to die. It seems like the former is true. He comes cheerfully thinking, dude, I got to get out of jail free card. It's all good. Saul should have killed me and he didn't. I'm home free. And then Samuel, verse 33, is going to continue.
There's another version that says from the original Greek version, it says this treatment of torment is worse than to meet death. So I'm actually excited about dying.
Hmm. Could be as well. It seems like, yeah, I don't know. But Agag's about to die, so he just isn't sure how this is going to go down. 33.
Samuel said, as your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women. And Samuel hewed Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal.
Wow. Samuel, this old guy, literally, yeah. Yeah.
It says Samuel just put Agag to death.
Hewed Agag to pieces. Okay, that's why you guys need to read a good version, like the NASB. It says it like it is. Okay. Yeah, hacked, hewed, hacked. Yeah.
Because he doesn't have the strength to drive it all the way through, so he's just going to sit here and...
And you guys can read into this a little bit. There's obviously a very normative meaning. As your sword has made women childless, you kill a virgin who hasn't had a kid, you've made a woman childless. Not to be graphic, but there are other ways that your sword could make a woman childless. So you're getting a picture of who Agag is. This isn't some innocent guy that God's just like, okay, I've had a rough day, kill somebody. This guy's awful, and God says, we're done, and I've let him live the the Amalekites 400 years beyond what I should have. I've been gracious in that 4 centuries of life that I've given these people. Now they're dead. And this is it. The Amalekites are done. So we don't hear of them moving forward. Okay. Samuel did not see Saul again in verse 35 until the day of his death. And Samuel grieved over Saul. And the Lord regretted that he made Saul king over Israel. What a rough end to a guy that started so well. And Saul's, we're going to see him through the book of, the rest of the book of 1 Samuel. He doesn't, the kingdom doesn't get transferred to David until chapter 31, and really even after that. So he's still going to be around, but at this point, his disobedience, his heart, God is grieved over his sin.
At least we see Samuel's heart, like, you know, that he's like sad that, you know, kind of lost a brother.
Yeah. Yeah, he's, why is Samuel grieving, by the way? What ultimately grieves him? I don't think it's that he lost a brother as much as it is what? The leader of Israel is in sin, and it grieves Samuel that that's the case.
What does it mean when it says, so shall your mother be childless?
You've killed others, I'm going to kill you. You're done. So your mom is now without her son. I'm killing you.
I read that as putting an emphasis on what he's done, because, you know, killing men is what you do in war, but killing a mother's child really puts a heavier weight on that.
Yeah. I mean, this tells you this guy has no, he's got a wicked heart, man. If he's going off women and children in the back of the line, like, that's just, take your medicine, fight man on man, like, and leave the women and children out of it. So he started it, God finishes it, unfortunately.
Well, we see Israel go through spirals through judges, right? And this happened back in Exodus? Yeah, this happened back in Exodus. So,
yeah.
Or Leviticus.
No, it's Exodus, you're right.
But you have 400 years of the Amalekites becoming more evil as Israel has turned from the Lord and become evil, good. So, I mean, you could just assume that the trend of the Amalekites over 400 years has not gotten better.
It's not an upward trend, right?
Right. So,
yeah. All right. Well, guys, we'll pause there, and tomorrow we will meet David, right? And we will see the beginning of his reign. So this is a fun section of Samuel. So see you guys tomorrow.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, bet.
Oh, see you.